Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rick Recking, a member of the congregation. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you, no matter your age or abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we'll offer our guests and visitors a chance to introduce themselves so we can get to know you more closely. On Sunday mornings, Prairie offers a wide variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member, as today's program is, a member of the wider community, or our consulting minister, Sandra Ingham. Our opening words are going to be read by Ann Urbanski.
And I think, Penny can tell me if I'm wrong, that these words were written about Mark Twain.
Yeah.
All right. He was a gay farceur and a saddened cynic, a romancer and a pessimistic determinist, a raffish Westerner and a candidate for gentility, a radical Democrat, small d, and a hobnobber with Standard Oil executives, a disinterested genius and a commercial opportunist, an author who liked to project his own divided character by portraying twins and dealing in mistaken identities.
Our chalice lighting today will be with Evan Creed and Joanna Hatch.
In the shadow of sacred mountains, we, the assembled Unitarians, light this chalice, marking this dedicated, sacred time together. We do so with intent, recognizing the mystery and wonder of life, the wisdom of all religions, the dignity of all, and our earth home, and our joint search for justice. This flame unites us symbolically with Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists internationally. It honors our heritage, our future, and the consciousness of this moment. So may it be.
Thank you. Story for all ages. So, and Penny's going to read it for us.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about Mark Twain with the big grown-ups. And he was known for telling tall tales. Everybody know what a tall tale is?
What?
Well, it's like a fisherman when he says, I caught a fish this big. Yeah, well, you think he meant this big, right? But when he showed you, he went like this. And what he really meant was from here to here. Oh, that's an exaggeration, we call it. Well, actually, Mark Twain didn't write any children's stories. He told them every night to his children, but they didn't get recorded somehow. But one of them he did write an outline for. He never finished it. But some modern day writers took it and they finished it. Problem being, I would love to read it to you, but it won't be published until September 26th. So look for it at your library. It's called The Purloining of Prince Olio Marjoram. Yeah.
Penny's a member of our congregation, Penny Eiler. She's the chair of the program committee and is a very effective chair at that. She does so many things for our society. We're lucky that she and Bill joined us not so many years ago. And I think she's a good example of what anyone can do here to take a leadership role. So, Penny, we look forward to your talking today.
At the start of the year, Don Haslett did a great job kicking off this year's program focus of the six UU sources. When the program committee decided on the six sources as an emphasis, I gave some thought to the source, Words and Deeds of Prophetic People. And who fills that bill for me? As program chair, I spend a lot of time searching for quotes for the opening and closing words. Inevitably, I run across a quote from Twain that's provocative and that I really like. It doesn't always fit the bill for that Sunday, but I really enjoy running across them. Little did I know, though, when I agreed to do this program on Twain, that I was falling down a rabbit hole. I am by no means an expert on Twain, and the more I researched him, the more confused I became. As our opening words stated, he is hard to pin down. He was a disinterested genius who at the same time branded himself before that was even a thing. I mean, he managed his image down to the point of always being photographed in a white suit. And that wasn't that hard back then, you understand. There were paparazzis had a hard time with their big cameras and everything. But he was a pacifist and an anti-imperialist who wrote the war prayer in opposition to the U.S. war in the Philippines. And he also turned his back on his ragtag Confederate outfit 2 weeks after joining it. He was able to square that with being a good friend of a Union Civil War hero, Ulysses S. Grant. And by the way, he made a fortune by publishing Grant's autobiography. Even his pen name contains a duality. Mark Twain is two fathoms, and it's a point where dangerous water becomes safe, and safe water becomes dangerous. This is the point of living on the edge. He had enough experiences for 10 lifetimes. Besides being a noted author, he was a riverboat pilot, a newspaper reporter, gold miner, lecturer, publisher, financier. He was a world traveler. Cities as diverse as San Francisco, Hartford, and Hannibal can claim him as a former resident. I could go on with his bio, but it took Ken Burns 2 nights to do him justice on PBS, and I recommend him borrowing those DVDs from your library. Until taking this assignment, honestly, I hadn't read that much Twain beyond Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn and The War Prayer and all the wonderful quotes. I've seen Hal Holbrook do his specials, and movies like The Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. But I've come to realize how important Twain is to American literature. Commentators all comment on how he was the first to use the American vernacular. Before Twain, for a book to be literature, it had to be written in proper English. In fact, one tie Twain has to our UU heritage is Louisa May Alcott. In a letter to Twain, she wrote, "Dear Mr. Twain, I have tried to read your latest novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but I find the characters and the incidents in the novel to be so low, so common, so vulgar, and so dirty that I say to you, Mr. Twain, if you can't write a better book for our young people than Huckleberry Finn, I suggest you don't write anything in the future." So that. She went on to work with the Library Board of the state of Massachusetts to get a law passed to ban the book from the state's libraries. Yes, for its dirty incidents. The next week, of course, Mark Twain took out ads in magazines and newspapers throughout the country. It said, "My latest book, Huckleberry Finn, by Mark Twain, has been banned in the state of Massachusetts," and in all capital letters, "for all its dirty incidents." Sales went through the roof, and the novel was saved. Hooray, Miss Alcott. However, she isn't alone in attacking Huck Finn. African Americans have criticized it for the use of the N-word and what they see is a demeaning treatment of Jim. Few other popular books have been so much attacked, vilified, or censored. Yet Ernest Hemingway proclaimed Twain's classic to be the beginning of American literature, and Langston Hughes judged it as the only 19th century work by a white author who fully and realistically depicts unlettered slaves clinging to the hope of freedom. Those who accused Twain of being a racist were right. He was raised in Hannibal in a Presbyterian church that denied the abolitionist policy of the National Synod of the New School Presbyterians. Twain, as a boy, had racial prejudice permeated in his community. His first existing letter home from New York reveals his mind on races. Soon after he left the town for the first time, he wrote his mother that he encountered the infernal abolitionist and missed old-fashioned slave culture. He even jokingly wrote that, "I reckon I'd better black my face," noticing that some African Americans in free states had better jobs than whites. His belief in the inferiority of African Americans still remained during the next decade while he was in the far western states. Twain wasn't struck blind by God on the road to Elmira, New York, but rather converted to an abolitionist by love for Olivia Langdon. She refused to marry Twain until he became Christian enough to be acceptable to her family, who attended the Independent Congregational Church, which was established mainly by Jarvis Langdon, Olivia's father and an ardent abolitionist. Later, the church was called simply Park Church, transcending sectarianism in 1871. In Twain's word, "She set herself the task of making a Christian of me. I said she'd succeed, but in the meantime, she'd dig a matrimonial pit and end up tumbling into it." Park Church is essential to understanding Mark Twain's religious conversion, as well as the Asylum Hill Congregational Church in Hartford. Thomas K. Beecher, the half-brother of Henry Ward Beecher, was called to be the pastor of Park Church in 1854. Unlike the oratorical style of Henry Ward Beecher's sermons, Thomas preferred a more frank and friendly style and attracted a large congregation from all denominations, even free thinkers like Mark Twain. He did not draw a line between in and out of church believing. Preaching never really converts anyone, but living does. He became one of Twain's best friends, and Twain became a faithful attendant at the church during his summers while in Elmira. Park Church contributed much to social welfare and justice in the community. Thomas Beecher and his wife Julia, Twain's closest friends in Elmira, nourished his Christian humanitarianism. And an interesting side fact, that Park Church still exists today as a United Church of Christ congregation. Looking back at his racial prejudice later in his life, Twain confessed, "Ignorance, intolerance, egotism, self-assertion, opaque perception, dense and pitiful chuckleheadedness, and most almost pathetic unconsciousness of it all, that's what I was at 19 and 20. By way of making personal reparations, Twain's philanthropy centered on one student in particular that had a powerful impact on society. He was Warner T. McGuinn, a man whose room and board Twain paid for at Yale Law School, and he graduated number one in his class and went on to become a force for civil rights movement in Maryland, and most interesting, a mentor to Thurgood Marshall. In a letter to the dean of the law school, Twain explained his reason for supporting McGuinn. "I do not believe I would very cheerfully help a white student who would ask for benevolence of a stranger, but I do not feel so about the other color. We have ground the manhood out of them, and the shame is ours, not theirs, and we should pay for it." Twain also made many contributions to scholarship at Lincoln University for African Americans. I identify with Twain and Huck and their fundamentalist church upbringing. The influence from Twain's mother was apparent in his later life, as strict adherence to church attendance and Bible study seemed to push Twain away from Christianity. Twain claimed that he often had to attend Sunday evening services at church as punishment from his mother, And as a result, Twain often considered this the worst discipline he endured from his mother. I was required to attend Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday evening, and don't get me started on revival services. And I can remember those altar calls at the end of the service, and I was praying that no one would come forward to be baptized, because then the service would go on forever. Twain's problem with religion is that he studied the Bible. Like Twain, the more I actually studied the Bible, the more illogical it became for me. Twain said, "It ain't those parts of the Bible that I can't understand that bother me. It's the parts that I do understand." I love the passage in Huck Finn, where Huck, using the UU source of direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which makes us move to the renewal of spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. In other words, listening to your gut. Yes, Huck used this to figure out what was the right thing to do about Jim. His church upbringing was telling Huck it was a sin to help Jim. And Huck was recognizing the humanity of Jim. Huck's heart told him what was right. After Huck wrote to Miss Watson telling her Jim's location, Twain wrote, "I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off. I laid the paper down and sat there thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking, and got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms. And we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. And somehow, I couldn't seem to strike no place to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing on my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping. And see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog. And when I come to him again in the swamp, where the feud was, and such like times. And he would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me. And how good he always was. And at last I struck on the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard. And he was so grateful, and he said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world, and the only one he got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was close pace. I took it up, held it in my hand, and was a trembling, because I got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied it a minute, holding my breath, and then I said to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. After reading Huck Finn, I found the Bible according to Mark Twain, thinking after reading it, my talk would write itself. Still blasphemous after all these years, this is Mark Twain's least likely to be adapted into an attraction at Disneyland. Get your copy before the school board burns theirs, was Bill Maher's assessment of the book. I came away from the book more confused than ever. He definitely has no use for organized religion. He finds the Christian God of the Old Testament an illogical, man-made creation. He is a huge fan of Darwin. His writing often makes fun of the creation myth in light of science, the science of evolution. However, his retelling of the creation myth through the diaries of Adam and Eve weave a charming tale of wonder and discovery. In telling the story of two adult beings as naive about good and evil or death as a newborn, and being held responsible for eating an apple, reveals his feeling about an unfair God. Twain had an obvious objection to the idea of the Christian God. One example of Twain's objection is found within his works, Letters from the Earth. Within this writing, Twain tells about the creation of man and about Satan being punished to earth as, While on earth, Satan secretly writes letters to the archangels Michael and Gabriel to inform them how humans live and act on earth. The views expressed by Satan in his letters essentially present the thought that man is incorrect in all of his ideas about God and Christianity. In the letter, Satan relates how God tells humans, "Thou shalt not kill," and yet it is plain that he cannot keep his own commandment. These same sentiments about the thoughts of God are echoed in his other writings. He writes in his autobiographical Dictations, "In the Old Testament, God's acts expose his vindictive, unjust, ungenerous, generous, pitiless, and vengeful nature constantly. He is always punishing trifle misdeeds with thousandfold severity, punishing innocent children for the misdeeds of their parents, punishing unoffending population for the misdeeds of their rulers, even descending to wreak bloody vengeance upon harmless calves, lambs, and sheep, and bullocks, as punishment for inconsequential trespasses committed by their proprietors. It is perhaps the most damnatory biography that exists in print anywhere. It makes Nero an angel of light and leading by contrast." Well, Twain has no use for the Christian God, I'm not sure he is willing to throw God out with the bathwater. In The Mysterious Stranger, the character of the beloved priest, Father Peter, espouses a very universalist notion that God is all goodness and would find a way to save everyone. While some have argued that Christianity is the national faith, and others that the church and synagogue celebrate only the generalized religion of the American way of life, few have realized that there actually exists alongside and rather clearly differentiated from churches an elaborate and well-established civil religion in America. This religion, or perhaps better, this religious dimension, has its own seriousness and integrity and requires some care and understanding that any other religion does. And depending upon the definition of Christianity, depending on the definition, Twain can be either be a Christian or an atheist, but according to the civil religion, he's a Christian. And as a final declaration about Twain, I quote, "I came in with Halley's Comet in 1983, and it's coming again next year, and I expect to go with it. It will be the greatest disappointment of my life if I don't go out with Halley's Comet. The Almighty has said, no doubt, there are these two unaccountable freaks that came in together and they must go out together." He wasn't disappointed. Yeah, one of the things I ran across was it said, before Mark Twain, our puritanical background kept authors from using humor, and that he really brought that into the American literature too. YouTube has a bunch of postings of top 10, top 100 quotes, and if your day is kind of blah, just go there and read those quotes. They'll brighten you up. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Penny. Our closing words are from Ernest Hemingway. Yeah. Maybe that's what I read. "All modern literature comes from one book by Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. Greet your neighbor, stay for lunch, and enjoy the party later. See you next week."